Hello and welcome to the Blazers Edge podcast. I am your co-host, Dan Morang. Just a quick reminder, you can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, pretty much anywhere you're looking for your podcast needs. And while normally I'm joined by our managing editor, Dave Deckard, technical difficulties is kind of keeping him on the down low for the week. But luckily, we've got plenty of depth in our bench as well here at Blazers Edge. And Steve DeWald, another Blazers Edge contributor, you can find him doing pregame analysis, pretty much anywhere help is needed, news reports, and now podcasts added to the repertoire. He is becoming a quick study and Blazer guru. Steve, welcome to the show, buddy.
I'm happy to be here, Dan. Expanding and going to try to fill those Dave shoes today.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Grand Poobah shoes are difficult to fill. I mean, that's pretty steep, but I like it. I like it. Just calling your shot early on. All right, so
I don't want to get too far ahead of myself.
So we're coming into a time when, you know, Nurkic fever is still really a thing here, and plenty of folks have heard Dave and I talk about Nurkic over the past couple of weeks here, I'm going to go and open the floor for you. What have you seen? What has been your takeaway? What do you like? What don't you like? I mean, if you can find something not to like, and what are you looking from him particularly for the rest of the season?
I mean, first off, when the trade first happened, I couldn't believe it. I called one of my friends, said, can you believe we got a young center and a first-round pick, and all we had to give up was Mason Plumlee. Luckily, I've been pleasantly surprised. He's kind of shed some of that reputation he had coming over from Denver. He's definitely motivated here. He definitely wanted to start.
I thought you said you were going to say he shed some of that weight, and I'm like, man, going into the fat jokes right out of the gate. That's
No, that's the off season. But I think it's tough not to like him. I think we haven't had a post presence. The Blazers haven't had a post presence like this in a long time. I mean, even when LaMarcus was here, he's working from the mid-range. I mean, it bends the court a certain way. But putting that big body in the post, just defenses are having a hard time reacting to that and chasing down the guards. I mean, Damian and CJ are putting up monster numbers since he's gotten here. There's really nothing you can't like. I mean, the 28-20 game was unreal the other night. I don't think I've ever been there for a Sixers game, and everybody was that crazy. So,
yeah, that means let's touch on that real quick, because it was Blazers Edge night, and we had 2,000 kids in the building, and most of the Blazers Edge staff members were all sitting in one section, and I'm fairly certain the vast majority of us around the first quarter were on triple-double watch for Nurkic. And to have that kind of a game against that opponent was kind of a bummer that game was necessary against that opponent. But to have that kind of game with those kids in the building was like you couldn't have written the script better for as far as making lifelong fans. Yusuf Nurkic made 2,000 fans that night.
Yeah, there's no the electricity in there was. All season, you know, I mean, the season hasn't been the most uplifting, to say the least. And that kind of made up for it a little bit the other night, regardless of the rest of this season, what direction it goes in.
Yeah, you know, speaking of electricity particularly, I haven't been to a game where the post-game after the court clears interview with a player, first of all, that hasn't happened in a while. Second of all, I haven't had it to where most of the arena, it's probably two-thirds of the arena, was still in the building waiting and cheering on Nurkic, and you could see kind of what it meant to him on the floor and the overwhelming emotion from the crowd, like just pouring down on him. It was definitely one of the cooler situations we've been in, not just this year and because of the situation that the circumstances the Blazers are with their record, but just that kind of fire within Moda. It's been missing for a while, and I think Nurkic, not just his performance, but his attitude, his persona, the way he kind of carries himself in these games, it that kind of, I don't even know what to really describe it, it's kind of innate in him. Like, he draws that out from people, and I think that's been huge for Portland over the last couple of weeks.
I think Portland's been exactly what he needed, and he's exactly what we've needed. I mean, as the fans, we're kind of freed from this dismal season, and Nurkic is freed from, you know, a bad situation playing time wise that he found himself in Denver. I think you couldn't like Blazers Edge Night for the kids. I don't think he could have wrote a better situation for the first few weeks he's been here. It's been unreal.
Yeah, I think the only way that that game gets better is if Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid like make miraculous comebacks and come out and play and still lose.
Yeah. Yeah, the Jahlil Okafor part is kind of the asterisk on that game, but I don't care how bad he is at defense. It's still 28-20.
He wasn't on the floor for the second half. I mean, Nurkic beat him up so bad in the first half that Rashawn Holmes was the guy that they opted to go with. I mean, think about that for a second. The 76ers opted for Rashawn Holmes against Jusuf Nurkic. I don't want to take shots at Holmes here, but I'm taking shots at Holmes here. He had no chance, and they thought he was the better, opportunity for the Sixers defensively than Okafor is or was. And I think that kind of goes to show where Jahlil Okafor is at this point in his NBA career, and I'm really glad the Blazers didn't pull the trigger, a couple days before it and before picking up Nurkic. Otherwise, they'd be in a much, much different place.
I mean, there was a few points that night where in the first half, you saw them going at each other and you're like, we could have been on the opposite end of this. This could have been a very different situation.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy at this point. It's just, the dude is just not an NBA player on that end of the floor. And that's an understatement. I mean, James Harden got vined and YouTubed, but I mean, Okafor, man, it's at a level that's embarrassing, but we'll flip away from that. And there's something that you said in there about Nurkic and his impact on his teammates, and one in particular, Damian Lillard. Damian Lillard was having a good season, his best statistical season of his career. Since the All-Star break, he's now averaging almost 30 points a game. He's at 29.4, shooting 47% from the floor, 37% from three, 5 rebounds, 6 assists. He's the third leading scorer since the All-Star break. He is balling out of control right now. Everything he's doing, the two guys that are scoring more than him right now are Russell Westbrook and Anthony Davis, who have had absolutely monster games since the All-Star break. And he's right there with them. Now, people can say, well, where was this earlier? Or how much of this is really Nurkic? And I think that's up for debate as far as Nurkic's impact. But I think the big thing here, and there's something that Dave and I have alluded to for quite some time, is that Dame wasn't right physically. He was nicked up, he was banged up, and that 10 days or so off for the All-Star break did him a world of good. I mean, what are you looking at when you see that?
I mean, I think the Nurkic thing is definitely helped him as far as creating space, but I think this has finally given him a chance to get his ankle right. I mean, he plays the most minutes, or he's in the top five every year that he's been in the league. So I think that rest is huge. I think it's just as much of an impact that Nurkic is in. But I think also outside of his scoring, I think what's important too is watching how Dame has welcomed Nurkic into this lineup. I mean, if there's a few times where if Nurkic, it takes a while for the big guy to get moving, but once he does, if he runs the court, it seems like he always gets the ball. He gets rewarded. And I think that comes down to leadership on Damian's part.
Yeah, and I think the funny thing with that is it's kind of a two-way street in that Nurkic in particular, when he's running the floor and he's getting a full head of steam, if he's not getting the ball, then, it's one of those things where he's not going to keep running the floor. I don't think that's just Nurkic in general. I just think that's every 7-foot, 300-pound human being on the planet. They're not going to continually run the floor if you're not getting the ball.
Joel Embiid excluded when he's healthy, but yeah, I agree with that assessment. I also think
go ahead.
I think Lillard too. I think the other thing too is he's getting the line more. He went 12 for 12 in the Philadelphia game. I think that explosiveness is there. He's getting to the rim. Even if he's not scoring, he's getting to the line, which I think that's indicative of a player who needed the rest and has got a second win in this part of the season.
Yeah. I think part of the Nurkic deal, and this was, I think, something that Dave and I alluded to and Adam Morris discussed, was spacing with Nurkic on the floor and how the Blazers were going to operate when you're talking about getting Nurkic the ball and clogging the lane. Now, if the negative were true here, in that Nurkic was clogging the lane, Lillard wouldn't have driving space. He wouldn't be getting to the free throw line. He wouldn't be able to put the ball on the floor and get there effectively. Whereas the opposite has been true, where Lillard's been getting to the free throw line more, knocking down more shots, there's more openings for him, because Nurkic, while he's taking up space, he's doing it in an effective manner. And they're not just posting Nurkic up. They're only posting Nurkic up 1.5 times more per game than they were previously with Mason Plumlee, as far as post touches are concerned. So it's not like they're just dumping the ball into him, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge style, in operating an inside-out offense. It's very tactical, but effective. There are minor differences in how Portland's executing their offense, but the impact that they have are huge. The big thing, and I've harped on this like crazy, is Nurkic's ability and penchant to roll, like what you're talking about, getting ahead of steam up. When he rolls off a pick and roll, the defense fundamentally changes versus him and Mason Plumlee. And the openings that that gives not only to Lillard and Nurkic, but guys like CJ, and I think more significantly is a guy like Allen Crabbe, who over the last couple games has become the aggressive Allen Crabbe we've all been begging for over the last couple weeks.
I think it definitely benefits creating space for those shooters, which kind of brings me to a guy who's getting healthy right now. And how do you think Evan Turner is going to fit back into this lineup? Do you think he's going to mess with the cogs on this one, or do you think those two will work well together in a pick and roll?
That's a really weird one. I want to say it'll work because Stotts and Dame and CJ and Nurkic and these guys will find a way to make it work. But floor spacing wise, it's a weird one. Evan Turner likes to operate in a lot of the same places that Nurkic does. What I anticipate seeing is Evan Turner working more with Myers Leonard. That's what I'm anticipating seeing. I don't think we'll see Turner and Nurkic as much as people may be anticipating. I think there'll be times where they're together, but I don't think those are two guys that are necessarily complementary players. One thing I have noticed since Nurkic came in, and that's with Myers Leonard, is that Myers has been working a ton more in the short role. And that by that, I mean he's going off the pick and roll and hitting the elbows and hitting those elbow jumpers and that little, I shouldn't say little, the giant 7-foot man floater, which to me is still the weirdest thing in the entire NBA. There's just something about a 7-foot-1, 270-pound dude rolling down the middle and then throwing up a floater that's softer and with more touch than most point guards. But yeah. People can call me the pessimist on this all they want. I just don't think that's a very effective lineup on paper, having those two together, unless you're completely surrounding them with shooters.
Yeah, I think going back to Myers Leonard, I think with him having the guaranteed role with Ed Davis out, I think he's played a lot better. I think the confidence thing is obviously, that's conjecture on my part, but
it's
always think that that's something that's always kind of been an issue. And I think he's taking his shots with confidence and he knows he's not going to get the hook. And then the other guy too is Noah Vonleh. Vonleh has looked good on the boards operating in that space that Nurkic creates. Now, I mean, there's a lot to be desired still from Vonleh, but
again, it's better.
It's better. Exactly.
And I think that's the best thing that Blazers fans can hope for right now is for things to be better. You're not looking, or you're not, I don't think you shouldn't be looking for drastic leaps, but slight improvements. It doesn't necessarily have to progress from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, in a progression. They could go 1, 2 and stay stuck at 2 for a while, and then all of a sudden then appear at 4 or 5. And you know, that could be the case with a guy like Vonleh, where one day it just kind of clicks. And I think that's what a lot of people are still hope for, you know, same thing with Myers Leonard. So
yeah, I've been with the Myers Leonard thought process on that for about 4 years. So
yeah, join the club.
We're gonna get there.
I'm not only a member, I'm also the president.
Correct. I send my dues to you.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of talking about, you know, the improvements and improved level of play, the Blazers are unbelievably are 5-1 over the last 6 games. With that, there have been 3 games, one we talked about in the Philadelphia game, where somehow, some way, a 76ers team missing Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, Jared Bayless. I think there was somebody else sitting out that night too. But basically, they're top three or four players. Dario Saric just making a case for being in that role, but he hadn't really leading up to this. But that team somehow pushed Portland to the brink. The next game, the Blazers pull out a 21-point lead against one of the hottest teams in the league, in the Washington Wizards, and blow that game. And then you've got the Phoenix Suns, who arguably are the second or third worst team in the league, and somehow find a way to stay in the game with the Blazers until the closing minutes. Game by game, what are you taking away from these three games and on both sides of the ball, and how does that make you feel going forward?
The Wizards game is still tough. I know you never want to be in a situation where you're blowing a 21-point lead, but it's made me second guess the replay protocol in this league. Either you have it and it works, or you get rid of it altogether, is kind of my stance on it.
See, I didn't have to bring it up. I have other people to bring it up for me. I think I've done so much complaining about officials over my lifespan that I mind dump all of that stuff. And it's ridiculous. I mean, go ahead and finish on this, and I'm going to come back and I'm going to go on my token rant that I get at least once a week.
No, I think the defense is definitely still an issue. I think some of the guards are adjusting to the ice format, having Nurkic sink back into the paint, and Damian and CJ already struggle getting off screens, as we all know here, anybody who's watched the team. The Phoenix game, I'll take a win, but when it takes 39 points from your best player to squeak past the second worst team in the Western Conference, it's not all sunshine and rainbows. I think this road trip that they're on right now will really we'll see if Nurkic fever is still here come Tuesday when they return to the Moda Center, because games against San Antonio, I mean, even New Orleans, how are they going to deal Atlanta. With, Boogie and AD? Well, Atlanta, I'm hopeful, because we were close in that game, or the Blazers, sorry, I keep saying we, the Blazers were close in that game. And that was when Nurkic wasn't suited up. He was behind the bench. So I'm interested to see how he does in that. I think Dwight Howard is an interesting matchup for him. I think the centers he struggles with are the guys you can, like Brook Lopez, I think, pushed him to the limit because he was able to take him outside of the paint, make him have obligations out there. So it'll be interesting to see how these next four games go.
Yep. Pulling Nurkic out of the paint, and it's kind of funny you're talking about the ice defense. If you ever looked at icebergs, what is it, like 80% of most icebergs are under the water? I mean, that's Nurkic, man. He is the iciest of icebergs, and his paint is his water. He does not come out of the paint. Defensively, it's just, and I don't blame him. You're putting him in a really bad position once he comes 15 feet away from the rim. He's just not going to recover very well there. As far as the blown call, probably caveat that with blown calls. In the post-game analysis against the Wizards, I brought up the blown call, and I didn't go into it too much, because it was just so blatant. But my whole take on officiating at the NBA level is this. For those that don't know, the NBA officials, while they have their own independent union, their arm of officiating, the whole setup itself is still housed within the NBA. And until that changes and that becomes an independent entity, we're not going to see a ton of changes as far as improvements in officiating. And I know it sounds crass, but I just don't believe that, because there's no leverage to make the change. I mean, yeah, the people can say, well, what if that call was made in the NBA Finals? It wasn't. That's not the leverage. If that call was blown in the NBA Finals, then you have that leverage to work with. But otherwise, it's much ado about nothing as far as the NBA level is concerned. Nobody's talking about that right now. And here in Portland, yeah, people are still angry and irritated about it. But at the national level, they don't care. They'll have the rule fixed for next year, and that'll be it. But if you pull the arm of the NBA, the officials away from the NBA, where the best officials in the world are an independent contractor, and they have a set of rules that they need to enforce, they have the leverage really to kind of work things around to where they can be more effective. And I think that's the biggest thing going forward is being more effective. And effectiveness comes with consistency. Consistency comes with training. And right now, I've had people ask me if there's a direct pipeline to becoming an official in the NBA. Do you know how to become an official in the NBA?
No, I do not.
It's a lot like Carnegie Hall, practice and knowing people. Yeah. And that's really what it comes down to. There's the D League. There's working in college. I've got friends who've been officials at you know, the highest levels of college ball, and they've been trying to get into the NBA for years. It just doesn't work. So, this is my one rant this week is I don't want to say end all hope, but if you're hoping for big changes from the officials and how games are officiated and called and structured and and transparency, that's not going to happen until that move takes place. So
what's your take? What's your take on the 2-minute report? Because I think I agree with a lot of what you said, and I think accountability is a big thing for that. And I mean, at least there's some form of transparency now with those reports coming out. But yeah, I mean, it's not perfect.
A lot of people don't like them. To me, I don't necessarily care about the last 2-minute report. I like the idea of the transparency, but I think it's kind of like wagging the dog a little bit. Personally, and I know this sounds awful, mean, whatever, take a look at the NFL or Major League Baseball. If an umpire or an official makes a really bad call, you know what's on SportsCenter later that night? That official with a press statement from the league saying such and such official has been fined or suspended for X amount of time or X amount of money. The NBA, you never hear about that unless it's a social issue. And what's ironic about that is Rodney Mott, the guy who blew the call and was with the pool reporters, one of those officials that was suspended back in, I think, 2007 for a social issue. I think the bigger thing going forward would be, what's the league going to do about this so things like this don't happen? I think a big part of that is, hey, Rodney Mott has been suspended without pay for 3 games. I think that does a big part of changing that. I've always been a big fan of anytime you're going to make punitive measures in place, the best and most effective way is to hit the pocketbook. And I think that's true pretty much across all walks of life. I would rather see, to me, that I think the biggest thing possible, and I know the Vegas bookies would love this information, and in fact, I know they have big parts of it anyways, are public records of officials' logs, basically. Grades at the end of a game, you know, 1 through 10, A through F, whatever you want to do it. And it's rated in positioning, effectiveness, consistency. And, you know, the refs are scored about that, because then you get to see what these refs are going. And a lot of that data is actually out there. And I look at it quite often, and you know, by the ref crew, it's going to be assigned for the most part. You can usually guess 75-80% accuracy about how many fouls are going to be called just by knowing what ref crew. I mean, I'll throw in an example. Anybody who knows, I've brought it up a million times. Ron Gerritsen is my favorite official in the league because he swallows his whistle. You know what you're going to get night in and night out. If a foul doesn't impact the play, he's not going to make the call. That's just away from the ball fouls that don't inhibit player movement heavily or anything along those lines. He's just not going to make that call. Meanwhile, somebody like Scott Foster or Zach Zarbar, they are going to make their presence felt on the court night in and night out, and they're going to tweet their whistle as often as possible. Stuff like that, I think it hurts the product in the long run. So, like I said, I'll get off of that rant for now, but I think that's the biggest issue facing the NBA as far as competitive play and the product itself going forward is consistency in officiating. Speaking of going forward, Blazers have 17 games remaining. That's it. I mean, we're talking the home stretch of home stretches. In those 17 games, they only have 7 road games. And one of them, by the time you guys are listening to this, will be tonight. So they'll have 6 road games remaining after this matchup. And only 6 games total against teams with winning records. What are you thinking right now as far as playoffs? Because as of right now, the Denver Nuggets are a solid 2 games ahead two in the win, one in the loss column right now. They just got done absolutely beating the brakes off the Lakers.
I think we should take this moment to celebrate a little bit because we have two Team Tank people on the podcast with Dave absent. So we can talk it up. We don't need anybody to rein us in. No, honestly, I think the schedule is very friendly. I look at the Blazers going just slightly above 500, how the schedule looks.
Oh, wow.
I think 9-7 is what I see. I think there's some games that I think we split one with Minnesota. I think is kind of where I might be a little more cautious than.
Yeah, they have three games against Minnesota left. That's big time. Minnesota could come out of nowhere to chase spot down.
You have the Nuggets right in front of the Blazers, but you also have the Wolves and who else is right
behind
them?
Pelicans and Mavericks are still kind of hanging around.
Yeah, the Mavericks are right there too. So, and I mean, New Orleans Noels look good in Dallas. I think those teams should be just as much of a threat if we can even catch Denver. So if the Blazers can even, I'm going to correct that. If the Blazers can catch Denver, but I begrudgingly think that they'll somehow find a way to make the playoffs and the lottery hopes will be gone. But I think it'll make Jusuf Nurkić very happy to bounce his former team out of the playoffs.
I mean, if you're looking for the silver lining for somebody, I guess it's Jusuf Nurkić getting to the playoffs and getting to knock his former team out of the playoffs. That's just not enough. The thing is, if you look at Portland's schedule, you're right. It's pretty favorable of the remaining teams that are chasing that eighth playoff spot. And I was looking at Denver. I believe they've got the Clippers and then a home and home against the Rockets and then the Cavs. Meanwhile, the Blazers have the Hawks and the Spurs, the Pelicans, and then it's basically teams that are under 500 the rest of the way. I mean, they've got a couple tough games. There's a game against the Jazz and a couple others. But for the most part, it's the teams from the lower end of the spectrum the rest of the way out, with the exception of one huge game, and that's against Denver, and then the three games against the Timberwolves. So I don't know if I can get on with the Blazers closing above 500. I think if they go anywhere near 500, they'll make the playoffs. But I just don't see them doing that, just because, yeah, they're 5-1 over the last six, but dear God, they've done everything possible to throw those games away against some of the worst teams in the league. So
I think if you're looking at the tail end of that schedule, you got a couple teams. I mean, you have a Lakers game. You have the Suns
Suns are tanking. That's two free wins.
Teams are going to go into full tank mode at the end of this season a little more than they are right now. So that could benefit the Blazers down the road. But
yeah, March should go into full tank mode, but that's for another time.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. But that March 28th game against Denver at home, Mason Plumlee's return, which I think we should have a moment of silence for his crotch shot that he received from Markieff Morris.
And yeah, Markieff Morris has been doing the Blazers dirty for the past week now.
Both Morris brothers were a nightmare to deal with for the Blazers this year, so I think we can rejoice that we don't have to face them anymore down the road.
Thankfully, they're not both on the Suns anymore.
Yeah. So I think we learned a lesson about how to treat Thomas Robinson, their old college buddy. We shouldn't have given up on him so soon, because the Morris brothers are taking it out on the Blazers or anyone associated with the Blazers.
So. Yeah, Denver's schedule down the stretch run is definitely tougher, but I don't know. Something in me is just saying that Denver is going to pull us out. The way they played tonight, and I know it was against the Lakers, but they look like a team that's kind of figuring it out down the stretch run. But I guess you could say the same about Portland. I mean, Dame is just balling out of control. Nurkić, and I want to go back to Nurkić real quick. Something about that Lillard said. He said he believes that Nurkić can average 20-12. Do you think he can average that at any time here?
I think that defenses are going to start to adjust to Jusuf Nurkić. we've seen teams come in and kind of let him do whatever he wants to an extent. I think when you see teams start to put pressure on him, he's already turnover prone. I think you could see things change. I think he certainly has the skills to be 20-12. I mean, I haven't seen somebody move that nimbly at that size.
Dancing
ever.
Bear, man.
Unless I'm watching Soviet highlights of Arvydas Sabonis, I don't think I've seen a big man move like that. So, and yeah, I'm already comparing Arvydas Sabonis. I'm in that camp. I'm
man,
real high.
There's a couple guys in the league right now that are doing some very Sabasy things. I mean, tonight, Jokic for the Nuggets dropped one of the no look over the shoulder passes from the pie post to a cutter. I haven't seen that since Sabas, so it's the Sabas flavor is definitely catching hold in Northwest Division right now.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm putting it down. I still don't think Portland makes the playoffs. As well as they're playing right now and as crappy as the schedule is as far as opponent down the stretch, I think Denver figures this out or Dallas figures this out, and that's a real bummer. But I think that leads us to the big sporting event coming up, and that's something I know you and I both are looking forward to, and that's March Madness. For those wondering, yes, there will be a bracket going up for Blazers Edge, a Blazers Edge Challenge bracket. So once that goes up, go ahead and get your picks in. But what are you looking forward to as far as the Blazers are going to have a pick? I think the lowest end humanly possible right now is probably 7th. Best case scenario is probably 9th or 10th. Worst case in the fact of making the playoffs, they're probably looking at 15th. Who are you excited to watch that kind of fits in that area of selection, and what teams and what players are you looking to watch kind of going forward and through the tournament?
I think for all three picks, I think Duke has guys that can fit all three of those spots. I know how much you like Duke, but Jason Tatum has been a guy I've watched all season. He was here at Hoop Summit in Portland last year. The guy looks the part. I think he can play the three right away, and once he puts a little bulk on, he could be, you know, play a little bit of four at the next level. I'm kind of bummed Cal didn't squeak in. I was looking forward to seeing how Ivan Rabb looked in the tournament. But I think Justin Jackson from North Carolina is another guy to watch. I think he's a ready-made guy for the NBA, and I think he could fit. If there still is a timeline in Portland, he could fit that timeline. Zach Collins for Gonzaga, I think, is another guy who, in limited minutes, has played next to Prismic Karnowski in Gonzaga, another huge lumbering center. And I think he has an inside-out game. He's a true seven-footer. But we haven't seen a lot of them. And I think that's the type of player that Portland might be looking to invest in with one of those picks. Take a flyer, because at this point you need it with the money that's tied up in this team. You need to get lucky in a big way in this draft.
Yeah, there's certainly no shortage of guys to watch as far as entertainment value. Lonzo Ball and his dad are going to be the source of at least 40 cutaways per game throughout the NCAA tournament. But the guys that I'm really interested in seeing are guys that I haven't had a chance to watch a ton of. So that's the not quite top-tier teams. So I know a lot of folks in the comments over the last couple weeks have talked about Caleb Swanigan. He's an undersized big, but he's a double-double machine, excuse me. And so I'll watch a guy like that. And then there's a couple of guys that have kind of piqued my interest that I want to get a clear picture of. Somebody like Jonathan Isaac from Florida State, who I've watched a little bit of and haven't had a chance to catch a ton of, but he's got a chance to carry his team. And I know a lot of folks have looked at a guy like Lauri Markkanen from Arizona. A lot of folks want to compare him to Dirk, but I think he's more of a Ryan Anderson type player. If anybody caught, you know, the write-up that I did last week as far as I think it was 13 different players to watch, those are the same guys that I'm kind of looking at going forward. But I think it's really easy as a fan to get caught up in what somebody does in the NCAA tournament and not what they've done over the entire year. who are you looking at as the guy that, that could possibly just catch fire and rise up a lot of boards?
Well, I think you mentioned him as Lonzo Ball. Just he's in that top three selection conversation. And with Markelle Fultz missing the tournament at Washington, I think if Lonzo Ball has a nice tournament, I think he could get himself into that number one selection conversation. The other thing, too, is getting back to Duke is Grayson Allen is worth the watch to see if he's going to be able to stay on the court. I think
the most
that is worth
player in college basketball.
Exactly. I mean, he is the Christian. That kid watched a lot of Christian Laettner film, apparently, because he rubs people the wrong way. So,
oh, I mean, it's not like he doesn't deserve it. I mean, I think he kind of relishes that role in just sucking up all the hate. I mean, that guy is just throwing hater steak out to everyone, and I don't know anybody who's not willing to bite. And the thing is just, the kid's talented. I think the guy that a lot of people may have coming of the boards because of his how well he did in the ACC tournament and what he's really done for Duke is the guy we haven't mentioned, and that's Luke Kennard. And he reminds me of a J.J. Redick type who, and it's not just because he's a white dude, it's because he doesn't have that explosive athleticism that so many people associate with that swing position. But the guy just, he gets buckets. And if you can score like that with relative ease, especially in the NCAA tournament, it's one of those things where you can just shoot up the draft board. And we've seen him go from a guy that really wasn't ranked a couple weeks ago to being a late first-round pick to a late lottery pick. And now I've seen some folks have him in a mid-lottery or mid-to-late lottery. So he's definitely one of those guys I think a lot of folks can kind of hitch their wagon to, so to speak, and you'll watch him as Duke progresses or does through the tournament.
Yeah, I think when I mentioned earlier that Duke has somebody at every selection for the Blazers, Kennard's an interesting person because I thought he's a guy that's going to be there at the Cavs pick if the Blazers want. But like you said, he's moving so far up the draft board. I mean, he might not be there with the Memphis pick at this point if the Trail Blazers keep all three of their picks.
What's crazy about this draft is that 1 through 7, I think that's the number I'm settling on, is the elite level projected talent going forward. And after that, there's no consensus. And somebody who's slated 22nd could go 10th. I think there's a lot of folks in this draft who are looked at not necessarily the same, but in the same vein as Thon Maker was last year, in that he was a, 18 to 26th pick who ends up getting picked early. And I think you could see a lot of that in this draft, and that somebody who's thought of in that range gets taken earlier. And I know everyone wants to talk about how great this draft class is, and I think it's because it's so loaded at that level.
And I agree. I think another guy that we haven't talked about is Miles Bridges. He's a guy who was in that, you know, top 7, top 9 conversation a few months ago. I mean, he's slipped a little bit, but there's a lot to like with him in today's NBA. I mean, he's got potential to be an outside shooter. I think he can guard 3 positions in the NBA level, but there's some stuff that's going to need work when it gets to the NBA.
Yeah, there's definitely issues with Bridges as far as what I'm concerned is the size, the wingspan. As an analytics geek, I have a really hard time with undersized players at the swing positions. And I think Bridges, and he's a guy like Draymond, and it's not just because he's from Michigan State and he's kind of positionless. He's looked at as just kind of an ugly duckling. Mm-hmm. Ugly duckling. Good God, I can't speak tonight.
We missed Dave.
But yeah, no,
I think Bridges' free throw percentage
his
also.
His game is kind of strange. Right?
Yeah. The thing that does bug me about his game when the limited time I've watched him is he doesn't, when a team puts a smaller defender on him, he doesn't take them into the post. He settles for outside shots against smaller opponents when you got to have that killer instinct, especially at that level. And Michigan State, for the large part, I mean, they're 19 wins coming into the tournament. But his talent's there.
And we're talking about guys like this, though. We're not talking about franchise-changing players as far as projection, right?
Yeah, I see them as someone you could plug into the Blazers system right now and maybe get some bench minutes next year. I think that's best case scenario, is you luck out with a rotational player in this draft. But I think the draft...
Man, it's kind of crazy, right? We're going from talking about, you know, if we're tanking the season, where there could be a maybe not the toppest of top flight players, but there's a guy in there that's the 5 to 7 range who you know you can plug into your lineup and is a starter from day one.
Well, you look at a guy like Malik Monk who could be there from 5 to 7. And if that guy comes to the Blazers, you're looking at a lot of trade flexibility involving possibly breaking up the McLillard backcourt down the road, because he's got that type of ability at the next level, where you could bring in that star power forward to play next to that complements Nurkic perfectly or plays with Dame perfectly. I mean, I don't want to get too heavy into projecting Nurkic's long-term future, but I think the Blazers definitely need to find somebody that's cap effective that can at least make it in case the Blazers have to trade Crab at a loss this offseason. You have somebody who can kind of step into that void. And when I say trade at a loss, I mean probably attaching an asset that the Blazers don't want to part with, to, you know, shed that $18 million salary.
Yeah, once the season ends, we'll have a better idea of where those picks are going to fall. And we'll know a little bit more tangible value with those guys going forward as far as the picks and what they could fetch in return, that kind of stuff. All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. Who is your tournament winner?
I'm a homer this year, and I actually have faith, but I have Gonzaga taking it all. I just want the Final Four, but okay, I'm going to put him there. You can judge me all you want, but
you have to caveat your homerism there.
Yeah, I grew up close to
Spokane. There's Gonzaga for you, and then there's the Ducks for a vast majority of folks here.
Yeah.
Do you think the Ducks make it out of the second round? What about to get you a whole lot?
I don't know. There's a team. The injury hurts that they had in the tournament. I think losing to Arizona.
Yeah, Chris Boucher. Yep.
That didn't help them out. I think Bell and Brooks are both legit guys. They're not guys I want necessarily at the next level, or at least with a first round pick, but I think they're talented guys. But I think the Ducks will definitely win their first game. I'll go that far. So
yeah, if they fall down, that's a bit much.
I think Kansas is a team to watch in this tournament if they can keep all their guys. They're very young, but there's a lot of talent on that team. Josh Jackson's one of those guys who's at the top of the draft that looks like he could have been an NBA player this year. I mean, he's raw, but
he's one of those guys that's for me. Frank Mason Jr. is the point guard for them, and he'll be a second round draft pick probably. Or he could be one of those guys that skyrockets into the first round, nowhere near his top 10, but he could be improving his value if Kansas runs deep. Kansas is the team that I'm really getting behind. They lack depth, but that's been my pick in most of my brackets. And yes, I'm one of those people. Let's go this way. Are you a single bracket or are you all?
I mean, I'm definitely the type of person that's going to fill out a bunch of brackets when it comes this time of year. There's definitely brackets I fill out that are to appease my own wants for my own favorite teams. There's brackets I fill out where I'm riding Cinderellas, and then there's ones that often end up with all number one teams in the Final Four. So,
you've got the all chalk bracket, which you're taking the ones. You've got your Cinderellas, where you've got your bracket busters, and then you've got your fairy tale. where you've got there's absolutely no chance, but I want to pick one bracket where my team actually kind of puts it all together, right?
Exactly. So who's your 12-5 upset special for this bracket? I mean, to put you on the spot.
That's one of those weird ones. No, there's a couple that we're looking at. There's a couple really bad 12 seeds.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I've kind of gone through and I've made a few picks. But it's terrible. I'm not going to submit my brackets until tomorrow when I know what the play-in games are.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and sit this one out. But I think we're kind of running up against it now, and I think it's a good place to end it up. And I just want to thank you, Steve, for hopping in.
No problem.
I know, the Grand Poobah shoes are difficult to fill, but you did a good job.
Thank you. Thank you. I owe it to listening to you guys weekly, so I'm trying to do my best impression.
And we have to thank Steve for coming in because he literally was been traveling all day, flying all over and stuck in god-awful airports and was still found a way to hop in and record at, you know, midnight.
Yep. It's in beautiful Salt Lake City.
Thanks again, Steve, for hopping in. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you, Dan.
And for Steve, I'm in Dan Meringue, or I am Dan Meringue. It'd be kind of weird if I've been Dan Meringue.
Oh.
But thanks for listening to the Blazers Edge podcast, and we'll go ahead and catch everybody next week.